Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. This show is a very special recording of a webinar sponsored by Arista Networks. Doug Gourlay got in contact to ask if we could organise a sponsored webinar to present their unique EOS software architecture to the Packet Pushers. Answer, yes, we can. Over the last couple of weeks, you would have seen me contacting you, and if you haven't signed up on the email list, it's time for you to head over to packetpushers.net and get on the mailing list so I can tell you about these things. And we had over 120 people register, 75 people attended, and subsequently I've had dozens of people asking for the recording. Here it is. On the program today, we have Ken Duda, who's one of the founders of Arista Network and the vice president of their software engineering team. Adam Sweeney, who's the director of their software engineering team and also a programmer, and Hugh Holbrook, who also is a programmer and co-author of the PIM sparse mode specification and a senior programmer in the Arista offer team. From the pushers side of the bench, we've got Ethan Banks back from hiatus. Of course, you'll know him well, and our very good friend of the show, Ivan Pepulniak. Oh, a warning. This show talks deeply around the software architectures of the operating system on your switches and networking equipment. And if you've never even thought about it before now, it's time you did. The nerd meter is somewhere around 8.5, I'd reckon. Are you ready? Here we go. Straight into talking about. The first thing to point out, for those of you who aren't entirely familiar, is that EOS is a piece of software that runs on the Arista switches. It's the operating system. In the same way that other companies have, you know, routers with their operating system and switches with their operating system, EOS is there, is the Arista operating system. And as Ken alluded to there, it's a ground-up development using all modern software. So I guess one of the first questions I wanted to ask is that, you know, with a brand new operating system that you want us to go and put into our mission-critical networks, how can I be confident that this software hasn't got bugs? You know, other people, you know, we have operating systems that take weeks, months, sometimes years to get all the bugs out of the system. How do we do it? How do I know that Arista's got something there for us?
Well, I would say that, you know, we're engineers like any other, so our code from time to time has been found to have bugs, but we do a bunch of things to greatly reduce the impact of those bugs and also to fix a lot more of them upfront than other vendors do. So to address this question fully, I really need to introduce the EOS architecture because it is a better architecture that leads to a more reliable switch. So maybe we can actually start there. We've got some slides up. Are the slides showing up for folks?
Yeah, I can see them.
Yeah.
So the EOS architecture at its core is based on Linux. And this is actually a kind of a founding principle of the software team, is that we had worked for years in all these sort of mutant switch operating systems that like had no relationship to the larger world of software. They had been sort of cobbled together from bits and pieces and grown up into great monstrosities. We just didn't understand why this had to be the case. Why couldn't you just build software in the way that disciplined software engineers have been doing for 30 or 40 years based on Unix principles, based on the principle of having a small operating system kernel, general purpose, well-tested, rarely modified, and then developing all of your functionality in separate user address spaces where each process does one thing, does that one thing well, minimizing dependencies on other address spaces such that each process can be independently started, stopped, traced, debugged, upgraded in the field, and you know the rest of the processes could just keep going. And like, Unix servers have done this for years. I mean, no one even imagines the alternative. Like, you're telling me I can't upgrade my name server without also upgrading my web server at the same time? And yet, this is the reality on, as far as I know, every switch operating system on the planet besides EOS, where EOS is built much more in the Unix philosophy. So there are a bunch of advantages you get when you follow the Unix model. You get software fault containment. This is the notion that when something does go wrong in the switch software because of a bug, the impact of that failure is contained to the one address space that has the problem. And then we get stateful fault repair. And this is the idea that that address space could be restarted. And when it starts, it picks up where it left off with the full state of the system behind it, rather than starting through some recovery path, replaying through some old log of old messages, desperately trying to catch up with everybody else and doing God knows what on the way there. And then we also support in-service software upgrade. And this is the notion that you can replace one process on the switch while all the others still run, while the switch is in operation. And this works just as well on our 1U switches as it does on our big modular redundant supervisor boxes. Finally, EOS supports a single binary image, which is the idea that the same switch binary runs on all of our platforms, from our virtual VMware deployment through our one-U switches and our large modular boxes, so one image for all your boxes. And last here is extensibility. And this is the ability, once you've done a good job of separating out everything into separate address spaces, your switch can be extended by adding new functionality into new address spaces, which minimizes the chance that the new functionality disrupts any of the existing stuff. And these are really just Linux server principles in action. To try to address your question here, one of the reasons why we don't have the same kinds of horrible crashing bugs that some of our competitors do is because we don't touch the kernel. We keep our hands out. So if you look on the next slide here, it shows the architectural components of EOS. At the bottom, we have a Linux kernel. We've gone to quite a bit of trouble to avoid modifying the kernel because the Linux kernel is running successfully in tens of millions of server deployments across the country, across the world. And if you don't touch it, you don't break it. So this is sort of the number one, or maybe, I don't know if it's the most important reason, but the first reason why bugs in EOS tend to have much lower impact than bugs on competitive platforms is because they're not in the kernel, because we didn't put any code there to begin with. All of our drivers, such as our SerDes driver or our ASIC driver, those all run in separate user processes. So our drivers run in user space. And I got to tell you, I don't know why more people don't do this. Drivers in user space is such a wonderful thing. The fact that it's a driver doesn't mean it should go in the kernel. In user space, you can still take interrupts. There's a standard Linux module called UIO that turns PCI interrupts into Unix signals. So you still get low latency response to system events. And the drivers have full access to the PCI bus. You can memory map the portion of the PCI bus relevant to your device, and your driver can program registers directly without any additional overheads compared with running in the kernel. It's really a mystery to me why more people don't do it this way. And it's so great to have restartable drivers that you can restart a driver process just the same way you restart anything else. And in fact, this is what we did in one of our very first deployments. This goes back to 2007, believe it or not, when we were the first time a switch left our building. It was in Lawrence Livermore Labs. We had troubles linking up with a certain 10-gig NIC, the vendor shall remain anonymous. They had power supply noise leaking into their 10-gig signal, but we were able to tune our SerDes driver to make it more forgiving of this unusual behavior. We sent the Livermore engineer a new instance of the driver, just an RPM, right? We use RPMs to distribute our software. And he installed the RPM on the switch, killed the existing driver. Our process manager started a new one. All of his links came up. The rest of switch function was unaffected, and he said to us, "You know, guys, vendors have been promising me this for 10 years, and you're the first to deliver. As far as I know, we're still the only ones to deliver on this." It's such a basic principle of server operation for so many years. It's such a shame it hasn't come to switches sooner.
Hmm.
We're really happy to be to have made that happen. Now, it turns out that I guess to give another example of how the architecture affects device reliability, is we shipped an instance of our software, this is a while ago now, but with a known core leak. One of our agents we knew would allocate, I think it was a few dozen kilobytes of memory every so often, and would run for about 2 weeks, then get up to 100 megabytes in process size, at which point we'd kill it, start a new instance. And we shipped that way. It was the interface manager, so the impact to the customer is if you change the IP address of an interface at the time the process is restarting, it might take an extra few seconds to apply to the switch.
Yeah.
So the impact was basically invisible. We expected no one would notice, and we were almost right. We got one tack case on it because the customer asks, "What does this message mean about restarting the interface manager?" And that was the total customer impact as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
And this same bug in iOS would have been a stop ship, hold the horses, you know, you're going to be redoing a router reload every 2 weeks sort of thing.
Hmm.
And it's just so nice to have gotten away from that.
Well, I guess that's something that people
pretty,
might...
It was actually pretty funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it was actually kind of funny because I think this was the first time that we sort of really had internalized to some degree the real benefit of the user space process model. Because, like, we had sort of expected this, and we went into it, and we're like, oh, no, we have a core leak in this agent. And then I think it was Ken who said, you know what? Who cares? We can just ship like this. It'll restart every 2 weeks, and it won't cause any problems. And it did not. Not a single customer noticed. So it really like, was sort of a wow moment of, like, gee, this architecture really holds together.
Yeah. For those people who are listening who may not know, certain versions of the iOS software is monolithic. That means it's compiled into a single executable and there's no modular loading of it, and therefore the ability to update just part of it isn't possible. And the advantage of the EOS software here is that by dynamically loading different pieces of the software, you can actually just restart them, or you can update just those parts from time to time. So hopefully that helps out. I've got a quick question from someone in the audience who said, can you provide a specific example of SFC-SFR?
Oh, absolutely. So a great example, so SFC, I think we've already talked about, that's the notion that when there's a problem in, say, the interface manager, it's only going to affect the interface manager. It doesn't require any of the other processes to restart at all. So that's an example of a software fault that's been contained to one address space. Another example, which is a little bit artificial, but it's a demo I like to do. If you look at the next slide here, one of the processes on our box is the LED agent. Its only job is to keep the link LEDs the right color. And one of the demos I like to do is to go onto the switch and send the LED agent a sig stop. A sig stop is a Unix signal that prevents the agent from executing any more instructions. It basically is like injecting a fault, simulating what would happen if the agent were to hang and deadlock in some way. And then you can go to the switch after sending the sig stop and pull a link out. And the link LED stays green. And if you've got a network ops background and you pull a link on your switch and the LED stays green, like, oh boy, it's time for a therapeutic reboot or maybe an RMA. But on the Arista switch, you can look at the syslog and you can see, oh, look, it syslogged the link down and spanning tree is reconfiguring and OSPF withdrew the routes and SNMP sent the trap and all the link down processing happened except for the LED. So this is another example of software fault containment where a fault in the LED agent doesn't cause anything else to behave any differently. And then as an example of stateful repair, after some delay, the process manager detects that the LED agent is hung, kills it, starts a new instance. The new instance reconnects to the system database, and then from the system database, it gets a copy of all of the current state, all the link states, which links are up, which are down. And the LED agent then pushes that state into the hardware, correcting all of the LED colors. And that's an example of stateful repair. There's no need for the LED agent. So in other architectures, like NXOS, for example, it's all message-based. And so on restart, the LED agent would have to receive a copy of all of the messages that were generated while it was down. So I wanted to try this out. I thought it would be interesting to send an agent and then pull a link in and out and in and out and in and out and then see if when it restarted, the LED went blink, 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 blink or not. And as it sort of tried to catch up and replay through all those old messages, I discovered that, unfortunately, in NXOS, there's no way for me to restart an agent. I have no administrative control over that. So I wasn't able to do this test. But I'm quite concerned about what would happen when you replay through old messages. You'll have some parts of your system fundamentally behind other parts, and goodness knows what's going to happen. And EOS is not an issue because of stateful repair. And another example comes from Spanning Tree. We like to do a demo where we go onto one of our live switches in our production network internally within Arista and kill the Spanning Tree process. You can sort of imagine what the reaction to that would be from a network ops guy. Like, here we are, operational, is now a good time to restart the spanning tree process. And the answer is, oh, no, don't touch that thing. But on an Arista switch, spanning tree restarts statefully, meaning it recovers spanning tree state from sysdb. What that means is that killing the process and restarting it, basically invisible from outside of the switch. You might notice a little bounce in the hello timers that the next hello packet comes out a little before or a little after he might have expected it. But this, of course, has no protocol impact. Mm-hmm. So if there were to be a bug in the spanning tree process, I don't think we've ever seen one ever exit in the field, as far as I know.
Yeah.
But if that were to happen, you would be protected.
So what's the sysdb? Is that something that you've developed to handle the messaging between your modules?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, sysdb, this is Hugh Holbrook.
Yep.
Sysdb is our sort of central system database, and it's the repository of state in the switch. And really, this is sort of like, I think, borrowing a lesson from sort of the database guys, which figured out in the 80s or maybe the 70s, that it's all about the state. And the key thing in a distributed system or in any system to make it reliable is maintaining the state. You know, you can build in the mechanisms that detect a process failure and restart the process, but then it's got to get itself back off the ground and recover the state that it had from before. And you can replay them. You can build a system that's sort of a message-oriented system in which you replay the messages from some point, but like, where do I replay the messages from, and what's my state when I replay the messages? The SysDB architecture is really where SysDB is our centralized sort of core database for the system that holds the state that describes how the switch is supposed to operate. And it holds some of the status of the agent. So it includes the counters for how many packets we've received. It includes all the routes, the fib, the rib is in there. It includes all the spanning tree state of the ports. It includes all the user configuration. So it's both the protocol state, the operational state, and the configured state from the user. Kind of SysDB is a database in the sense that it's sort of all the database, all the data that describes how the switch operates, but it's a different database from what you might think of in sort of SQL terms or something. It's more of an object-oriented sort of style of database, and it really has a different focus. So it's focused on tight integration with the programming language, so it integrates tightly, and on notifications of changes. So whereas sort of an SQL database is sort of
query-based,
right? You like, it's for bulk batch operations where you send in a query and say, give me back all of the records matching a particular criterion. The SysDB database is one targeted for notifications and fast updates and high performance. Because in an operating system switch, it's constantly changing. There's counters changing all the time. There's protocol events changing. You know, users can clear MAC addresses, which flushes all sorts of things in the state. Ports can go down, causing hosts to move at a rapid rate. So it's like high update rate and not focused on sort of the transactionality and all the costs that come with that in a database. So, you know, a traditional database focuses on sort of the ACID properties of transactions. Consistency, durability, rollback, all these things. And
so that's one of the enablers for in-service software upgrade. So you've got the ISSU and the SysDB is part
exactly.
of what... I mean, that's just one outcome of that feature.
Exactly. And it's the cornerstone of the restartability of the processes because the state lives in the database and the processes recover it from the database.
This is a fundamental architectural innovation in EOS.
Yeah.
No, I think that's exactly right. I think when you break something into lots of processes, you've got to figure out how do I coordinate those processes. And the Unix lessons here don't actually teach a lot, because if you think about the way the processes coordinate in Unix, they're so loosely coupled that the problem's basically easy. But in a switch, it's much harder. When there's a link down event, it affects everything, and you can't just say, well, I didn't notice that link down event. That's just not good enough. Mm-hmm. And so the state-oriented coordination of multiple processes may be the fundamental architectural innovation in EOS.
A couple of questions from the audience here then about that how does the architecture complicate software version and management if there's this many modules? So how do you package this up and make it easy to administrate?
Well, I mean, it seems like kind of a different way to look at things in my mind, whereas if you're a Cisco guy used to iOS, you've got one binary, you'll load it done, you know what version you're on, you don't have to think about it. This almost sounds like, you know, is the OSPF module a version and STP's a version and so on, or is it all kind of a unified package?
Well, the way we deliver our software is in this sort of traditional Cisco model of giving you a single blob that you install onto the switch, and that you can have multiple of them sitting in flash and pick the one you want to boot from. So in that sense, we take care of the problem for all of the major versions of software that we ship of coordinating what version of each of those packages you mentioned. It is in the blob, right, and that they all work together and have been all tested together.
There is an interrelated dependency there. You got to really load the whole package of modules together. You can't say, I'm upgrading OSPF today and, you know, just pull down one thing that might be too new to run on your older rest of your kernel and module.
Well, at its base, you can't do that because you get an integrated suite of all these packages in one blob together. One of the things we've done for our customers, though, especially on the occasional need to fix a bug on a critical system that they don't want to move to an entirely new version of all the software, is to provide them with individual RPMs, right? Just like you might on a Fedora Linux system, you might upgrade just one of your packages, and we were able to provide people with a package and a new RPM that has whatever the particular bug is that they need fixed in it. They can install that.
I'm sorry, that's a case-by-case as opposed to the standard way that you deploy packages and make them available to customers.
Yes, we've tried to keep this simple, at least to date, so that we're not forcing onto our customers the need to manage a large diversity of packages and having to deal with all the version control and understanding version compatibility themselves. Instead, we've really leveraged this for targeted deployments where were able to upgrade individual pieces of the system or to add pieces to an existing system without without having to upgrade everything else at the same time. And we deal with the versioning even there. Yes, and we use the ARP. That's right. You can upgrade your routing protocol software, your spanning tree software, and we actually use the RPM versioning controls to make sure that you don't accidentally install those RPMs onto a version that they're not compatible with.
Does that help with the software development, because you can actually have one person working on each section, or, you know, or a team working on each section, and they don't need to be interdependent with other parts of the kernel?
Yeah, I'll admit it. When we first developed the EOS architecture, we were being totally selfish. It was all about developing the software. Like, we weren't thinking about the customer at all. It was all about, like, man, we are so sick to death of the software development model at our big competitors. We want to do this in a way that makes sense to us as engineers. And so this was you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, it was all about, like, how do I get it to a point where I can write my feature and avoid the situation where, after staying up until 11 o'clock at night hacking on my code, I finally get it downloaded into a router where it runs for 4 seconds and then crashes in some part of the code I've never heard of, and I'm dead in the water, because I just, like, hate that. So that's exactly what we did. We broke the software into lots of modules so that I could work on my feature, and if Adam's spanning tree is crashing all over the place, it just doesn't matter to me. I can still get my work done. And the fact that there's all these customer benefits was like, hey, wait a minute. It's like Hugh said, this is, like, great for the customer also. How fantastic, you know, like this win-win. But, like, that actually wasn't why we did it originally. Maybe I shouldn't admit stuff like that, but that is the reality.
Now, you guys have talked about the single image across all of the Arista hardware platforms. How much the same is it? I mean, if I go onto a smaller box, does it have all the same features? If I loaded the same blob, as you call it, is everything there on the smaller box, or is there a diversity of features depending on what hardware platform you're running the code on?
It really falls out of the beauty of running on top of Linux, right? The fact is that all of our software, it's just Unix software. The servers that run inside all of our, we call them agents, right? But all of our agents, they just run on Unix.
They run on our development systems just the same way they run on our switches.
Exactly. When I test my spanning tree protocol implementation, I run it on my laptop, right? I run N different copies of it on my laptop, and I interconnect them in ways that I could never wire up in the lab. But that same exact binary that runs on my laptop runs on the switch. I don't compile it differently. I don't link it against different things. It's the exact same code. And so that's the same way that I can run that same code on my laptop and on the switch, I can run it on each of the variants of switch hardware that we run. Because at their core, they're each an x86 CPU subsystem running Linux with our binaries running on top of that. And those binaries have no idea which kind of Linux system it is underneath. You know, the fact that there's different hardware hanging off the PCI Express bus on this switch than there is on another one, 90% of the software really doesn't care, because it's just Unix software. The only parts that care are the drivers that manage those specific pieces of hardware. Then we just fire up the right server to manage the right piece of hardware, and we don't fire that server up when it's inappropriate.
Sorry, I got a question here from Simo. He's saying, is there any possibility for developing your own software modules on EOS? Which also leads into a question around the integrity and the structure of the software, where I know we haven't talked about it quite yet, and maybe you're coming to it, about, you know, you can actually do your own development, and we've got various pieces of thing, you know, how to extend the system. Is that... So two questions there. One is, can you develop your own modules? What can you do and what can you not? And then tell us about the security and the integrity of the system if somebody does.
Yeah, so in what we've basically done with EOS is it is the first open switch operating system, in the sense that we give our customers all the same tools and access to all the same facilities that we as engineers use to develop on EOS. So program in C++ or Python just the way we do, connect to the system database, you have all the facilities of the switch at your disposal. As in terms of what you can do, there's really three levels of integration. The easiest or sort of least deeply integrated level, you can run any standard Linux software on the switch. You can run things like TCP dump is a great example, right? Early in Arista's life, we were having a spanning tree interoperability problem with Foundry. We were trying to help the customer out, and we said, well, can you please capture some spanning tree frames, because we want to see what this thing is sending us. And the customer said, well, you know, that's really hard because it's a point-to-point 10 gig link and I don't have a 10 gig sniffer. So, no. Just TCP dump the spanning tree frames. The customer says, what? Go onto the switch and type bash sudo TCP dump -i Ethernet 6. You can do that? And then the next word out of the customer's mouth was an expletive. And then the next question was, do you make 1 gig switches? Because it became obvious that the foundry box was .1Q tagging the BPDUs, which is not exactly .1D behavior. Running standard tools is pretty useful, and it's very little work because you can just basically just rip them off the Fedora repository and stick them on there. So here's a screenshot of a TCP dump running on the switch. It's just standard, you know, Linux TCP dump. And then on the next slide here, I have an example where I reach out to a Fedora mirror and pull a thing called fping onto the switch. And fping is a handy little tool that sends out lots of pings all at once in parallel to lots of different IP addresses and gives you a very quick sense of which hosts are up and which hosts are not. And so you can see there, I just copy it from a Fedora mirror into a Magic Extensions folder. I activate the extension, and then I've got fping on the switch. And, like, it just works, right? So this is a really easy way of just running stuff you've already got. The next degree of integration involves getting a bit more into the guts of EOS itself and talking to SysDB fundamentally. And doing that, you can automate pretty much any management task, or you can implement pretty much any control protocol that you want to implement. We've got customers doing things like implementing custom Mac routing protocols, so routing on Mac addresses by adding and removing static Mac entries to and from SysDB, basically treating the static Mac table like sort of a layer 2 fib, if you know what I mean. It's a little esoteric, but it's a cool thing that, you know, good luck doing that on anybody else's switch. So that obviously requires a little more on the software engineering side and a little more familiarity with our stuff. The next level of extensibility really gets out there beyond what a lot of people are willing to do, but we do have a couple of partners doing this. We work with us, get a source license, and hack on some of the driver source code to take advantage of switch hardware features that we haven't otherwise exposed. And this is not for the faint of heart, I'll say, but it is possible with EOS. And again, I don't know of any other partner where this is possible. And this is possible fundamentally because of our modular development environment, that you can build just that one package independent of the rest of our software.
Well, I mean, I'll just add one thing, because Ken went really fast by the example of TCP dump. This is sort of a different topic. But, I mean, I feel like this is one of the ways in which the EOS architecture has been really successful, and one of the things I'm really happy about how it worked out is just the integration of standard Linux tools with EOS. Because you can build an operating system on top of Linux, or a network operating system on top of Linux, in lots of different ways. But building it on top of Linux in a way where the interfaces, which really are so fundamental to, you know, networking, the network interfaces are exposed to the tools, and the ability to use the open source tools to do things like TCP dump and ping and traceroute and the tools that all the Unix admins are incredibly familiar with is just so powerful. And to have access to that and to be able to send packets. I mean, it's really tremendously powerful. We have a little tool that's part of EOS that's called EthXMIT that lets you craft an Ethernet packet. And you can just send it, and it's incredibly useful for testing and network debugging. You run EthXMIT. It's actually a, like, 100-line Python script. If you have EOS, you can do cat user bin EthXMIT and look at it. It's like a 100-line Python script that just generates packets. You can run it on any server, but it's tremendously useful from a network debugging standpoint. And the fact that you can do EthXMIT ET3 to send a packet out ET3, and then on your next Arista switch, you can do TCP dump on ET3 to see the packet showing up and see whether it came out tagged or not, whether it got there. It's just been tremendously useful, and I think it's a real success story, in some ways sort of accidental, again, or not accidental, but sort of only half intentional, because it's like we developed it for us because we wanted to do it this way, but it just turns out that it's such a useful capability.
No, I can see some people looking at all this power and flexibility and saying, that's cool, but what about security? Is this thing more vulnerable to DOS attacks? Is it more, how do you secure this switch to make sure that the integrity of what the box is really intended to do, which is forward frames and packets, stays intact?
Let me take that. First, I would say that extensibility is something that is a door that you can open if you want, or you can leave it closed. Like, some people think the idea of running third-party software on their switch is the craziest thing they've ever heard. And guess what? You don't have to do it, right? Just like you don't have to put apps on your iPhone, you don't have to put extensions on your switch. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part is that in terms of security, open source has a very good track record. And the reality is that open source code has been gone over with a fine-tooth comb by all the experts, white hats and black hats, whereas proprietary code is only made passed over with a fine-tooth comb by the black hats, right? I would be very careful about assuming that proprietary code is more secure. It's more opaque, which means it's harder to know how secure it is, but it's actually far less secure, and Linux is demonstrating that by running securely on millions of servers all directly connected to the internet. And so EOS is secure for exactly the same reason. We're dependent on the same core of Linux that all the servers out there are dependent on, namely the IP stack and SSHD. And that is it, you know. Otherwise, all the ports are blocked off. We're not running, you know, the printing subsystem or whatever. There's no X server mm-hmm. running on the switch, right? So we don't have any of those kinds of avenues for security holes. So I think the security situation is really actually very positive. With the point that you're installing extensions, there's always the risk that someone's third-party extension has some Trojan horse issue with it, just like whenever you install software on a server. And I'm not sure what to say about that other than encouraging you to work with your extension provider to audit the code or whatever is required to meet your sense of best practices.
Okay. Now, if you allow a third-party extension to interact with SysDB, which obviously we have to do, is SysDB protected in some way so that, for example, I can't just write a script that would modify, for example, OSPF topology database?
Now, each mount, so we use a metaphor of mounting, that an agent mounts different parts of SysDB, and each mount is associated with access, read-write access versus write access. And if an application violates the mount permissions, then SysDB simply disconnects it. Today, we haven't implemented any permission system, meaning there's no way to configure today which extensions are allowed to mount which parts of SysDB, but it's there in the architecture, so this is an obvious extension that we'll be doing at some point in the future.
So today, every extension can write to every portion of SysDB?
Only if the extension mounts it writable, and it's easy to tell from code inspection which portions of SysDB are being mounted.
By the way, going back to SysDB and the previous slide, did I understand it correctly that you're storing all the state for all the programs running on the switch in SysDB?
That's correct.
So, for example, if my OSPF would crash and it would be automatically restarted, the topology database would still be intact, so it wouldn't have to download it from the neighbors.
I think in an ideal world, that would be true, you know, and that's where we're going to get to eventually. In our current OSPF implementation, it doesn't take advantage of that fact. Instead, it does reestablish its neighbor relations and rebuild the LSDB. We have a very grand architecture that allows us to do many things, but it's not always fully taken advantage of in every implementation of every agent. And so OSPF is one example where we have not yet done that. So today, if you kill off the OSPF process, it restarts and reconnects to its neighbors and rebuilds all of that.
But the spanning tree is not the case. So with spanning tree, we do recover protocol state from SysDB on spanning tree protocol restart. So it varies from agent to agent what the agent does with the state in SysDB on its initialization.
But the architecture makes it possible with, you know, varying degrees of effort depending on the protocol to integrate. And it really depends on the protocol how easy or hard it is to take advantage of the state. And IGMP snooping is another case where the agent restarts without any impact. The agent that controls the Linux kernel and programs the routes inside the Linux kernel controls the interfaces. That's similar. You know, many, many of our agents are like that. It's not every single one.
Okay, so maybe we should move the conversation on to something a little more advanced and focus on some of the features of in the networking protocols, because I love the story around EOS, but there's also some amazing features in there. And the one I'm quite fond of today, because I've spent the last week tracing down latency problems inside of a network, is you've got the LAN-Z latency analyzer product. Now, how does that work, and how does that integrate with your software architecture?
Well, LAN-Z is a new feature that we just shipped on Saturday in the 4.7 release of our software. what LANs does is it takes advantage of some features in the forwarding ASICs from Fulcrum that we use on our 7100 series switches. The Fulcrum built in some mechanisms that were originally intended for some of the early attempts at network-wide flow control at layer 2, where they were for sending congestion notifications from a port back to the source port in the network. We sat around and looked at, you know, we were very interested in how we could know when we were seeing congestion on a port. And we one of the games we play as switch software developers is the Twist the Hardware game, in which the engineers sit around and come up with creative ways to use the hardware in ways the hardware designers never expected. And this is one instance of that, where instead of using those notifications to send back to a source switch in the network and tell it to do something to its connected host, we said, well, what if we send those notifications up to the CPU, right, just right there on the local switch? That gives us a way to get the switch hardware to tell us, help, this port is getting congested, you know, it's the queue is this deep, right? It gives us a record of how many memory segments deep the queue is when it crosses a threshold, and starts sending records indicating that up to the CPU. Around that, we built LANs. LANs build a database in memory of all these records that are coming from the hardware to give you a historical view of congestion on the ports in your switch. As far as I know, this is something nobody's ever done before. You know, this is our very first version of it. It doesn't do everything we'd love it to ever do, but it's pretty cool to start getting a view of when did my queue cross, you know, 50 segments deep, at fairly tight granularity, time indications of when this occurred. And today, those records are stored in memory, and you know, obviously this is a historical record that could grow very large over time, so we limit our window of time for which we track this for each port, but you can query the state of this at any time, and we do things like allow you to export the contents of that in-memory database as a CSV file for you to spew out to your own tools where you can manipulate them however you want. Going forward, we're looking at ways to stream that data off of the switch so you can have an application running on a server that's just receiving the stream of congestion notification updates coming out of the switch, and assuming your server has bigger disks, more memory, that sort of thing, you can keep a much longer historical record of what's happening in your network. That level of visibility is something people have wanted for a very long time.
Yeah, I'd like to highlight two use cases for LANs. One is in the high-frequency trading space. We have customers who are extremely focused on latency. They're counting things down at the level of, you know, hundreds of nanoseconds, and they want to know about every time the queue depth gets more than about a microsecond. So they tend to set the LAN thresholds extremely low and get real-time data into whether or not they're meeting their latency targets in the network. The other use case is actually a much broader one, and it's a little bit less understood, but, you know, the bane of the network operator's existence is a call from the application guys saying the network is slow, right?
Yeah, let me tell you about the meeting I just got out of.
Yeah. I mean, it's a real pain, and if you look at why the application guys say the network is slow, it's not actually usually about latency. It's usually about packet loss. Somewhere there's packet loss causing TCP to back off and retransmit, and that's causing the application to get slow. Now, how did we get to the point where there's packet loss? Well, why is there packet loss? Okay, sometimes it's a flaky transceiver, but usually the reason for packet loss is congestion. That somewhere in the network, there's fan-in, there's a bottleneck link somewhere, and the queue builds up to a certain point. When the queue overflows, it starts to drop packets. And the first sign you get of this is application slowness. If you think about it, this is really crazy, because your network didn't do this on day one. It's through more and more use over time that the queues got deeper and deeper. Yet there's no visibility. No visibility into the queue length. You're not given any warning that you're driving towards a cliff, you're about to go over, but the switch doesn't tell you. And so this is actually what LANs does, because you can set a queue length threshold, which is at, you know, 50% or 75% of queue occupancy, and now you're getting alerts from the switch at the point that your queues are getting sort of close to full, but before any application person has seen any bad impact, and you can take proactive steps to expand link bandwidth, to add more links to the aggregate, to provide alternate paths or multipath routing or whatever you need to do to get the bandwidth to the point where the application isn't going to have a bad day before there's been any problem. And so I actually think that for the broader market, that's the true value of LANs. It's not about whether my packet was 1 microsecond or 2 microseconds, because outside of some specialized applications, it doesn't tend to matter too much. It's about, is my network going to start dropping packets, and can I find out before the damage is done?
Okay, but how is this different from monitoring the SNMP counters that we usually have on the interfaces? Now, I don't know what individual switch vendors do on the switches, but I know that on the routers, I could always look at the queue depth and the packet drops.
Oh, this is so much better, because monitoring queue depth, you know, you've got a 10 gigabit interface, and it's sending 15 million packets per second. Well, I can lose a whole lot of packets, and even if I'm queuing, even if I'm checking my queue depth, say, 100 times a second, which is pretty infeasible with SNMP over any significant number of interfaces, it'll always look uncongested if I have bursty traffic. So if you have bursty traffic, which
you do, because all traffic in networks is bursty.
Exactly. You know, it's okay. Incast and you've Panassa-style file systems with traffic bursting back. You know, someone makes a file system request, and the traffic bursts back to you from 50 file servers coming back through one congested interface. Like, that's a burst that causes loss, and it makes your disk access look slow. But, like, you never see it because it's a one-time event if you're just polling. So the beauty of the way we've done the LANs feature is you can't miss it. It's a hardware event. So when the queue goes over the threshold in the pipeline, you get a notification to the software, and we deliver it. So it's really dramatically better, because it's an event that the hardware tells you about, so you just can't miss when you cross that queue threshold.
So effectively, you've turned polling task into notification-driven system.
Yeah, exactly. It's a notification-based system that doesn't miss the event.
But it's not just more efficient. It's like actually correct, in the sense that through polling, you can never see a microburst. I mean, your chances of seeing a microburst are infinitesimal.
Right.
Whereas with a notification-based system, you're guaranteed to see it.
And you can have loss, and you know, of course, with networks, like, it doesn't take a lot of loss to result in really bad behavior. You know, so you can look at an interface. I mean, if you have an interface that is catastrophically losing traffic, you know, those are the easy problems. Like, those are ones that you already need help with. You know, your counters, your alarms are going off like crazy already. But it's particular application dynamics that cause sort of the burst of traffic or the microbursts, where, like, the loss is happening periodically on, say, disk access, and so you're going into timeouts or backoffs, and synchronization in the network. Those are the problems that is really, really hard to find without something like this.
Okay, now, assuming I love this feature, and I would like to use it on my switches, but for whatever stupid reason, I still have to test a new software in lab before deploying it, is it possible to just take this feature and deploy it on an older release of your switch?
Unfortunately, no. It really isn't. Our system is very decoupled, but it's just not quite that decoupled yet.
Not too bad.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
We want to get there, but you know, we're not there today.
I mean, I think in theory, sort of, but it, like, you know, it only touches a couple agents, but one of them is the agent that programs the forwarding ASIC, and that one is just so central. And you know, we don't make one change in the forwarding ASIC programming at a time. We're adding multiple features at a time typically, and so we don't have a big enough QA effort to really.
But here's what we can do, what we have done in the past, is for very big customers, we will take a feature or some kind of change and backport it to an older version of EOS and then produce RPMs that then do make that one feature available on that one older version of EOS. So that's something that we have done and have the technical capability to do.
But we're not volunteering to do that for you.
Unless we were very, very big customers.
I guess so.
Got a $5 million PO handy, it'll happen.
Yeah. Yeah, we got to take this all out for milkshakes.
Yeah, milkshakes.
I've got a couple of questions from the audience I'd just like to shout out here. So there's two or three questions from the people who are asking about how software quality is assured. So I seem to remember in the pre-discussion, just before we opened up, we were talking about you have automated testing and auto-building of the code at a significant level. Do you want to touch on that briefly?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. you know, we heard from some of our customers that some of our competitors were going around telling everybody that Arista didn't have any QA, to which my response is, that's right, we don't. And it's wonderful. We have over 800 happy customers and no QA at all. You know, how do we do this? The answer is that we've automated the entire thing. That is part of every developer's job to both create the feature and also create tests that prove that the feature works. And they submit that those two things together as a unit. And the tests run 24/7 across a large test bed of switch hardware. And this system is just, I mean, again, this was another thing that we did not for customer benefit, but for our own benefit as developers, because dealing with manual QA used to drive me nuts as a developer. You get these bug reports that say, I wiggle my left finger and I press this button and then the switch crashed here. And then, you know, you get this bug report and you try wiggling your left finger, but guess what? The switch doesn't crash. And so it's like, you know, it's very difficult to track down these tricky problems. And I got to the point where I actually wrote a program that ran on my desktop that monitored the bug database. And as soon as anybody opened a bug on me, I'd run to the QA lab and hope that I got there before the person cleared it, so I could see what was actually happening. And I was like, what am I paying these people for? Is this so what we did instead was automated the whole thing. Our scripts are extremely patient. They'll run the same test over and over again. Because that's the other thing that happens in the traditional QA environment is that some funny problem happens and the developer tries it and says, well, I couldn't reproduce it. Can you please reproduce it for me, Mr. QA person? And the QA person tries, make a real effort, run 2 or 3 hours, but you know they can't just do that. They have to go get through their test plans. They try for a few hours and they can't reproduce it. They mark the bug unreproducible. It's closed out. The product ships. And guess where the problem gets reproduced? That's right, in your network. So our auto test hardware is extremely patient. It will run the same test 24/7 over and over again. Plus, by automating all of the test cases, we avoid the regressions. And this is something that's driven customers crazy with other vendors, is that you've got a feature that works in one version, but the next version comes out, and like the feature doesn't work at all. Like it's really broken. Well, how did that happen? And the answer is the marvels of regression test. So what regression test really means is we didn't really test it that much. Because you can't. You can't afford it in a traditional, you know, carbon-based test system, because you have the test resources to thoroughly test the new features, but you just regression test the existing ones because you're hoping they didn't break. That's not what we do at all. We run all of our tests on every release, and we need to get more test hardware to scale up the number of tests. We just buy more test hardware. Like, it's not at all hard to scale up our test lab, and so we don't have these same kinds of problems with regressions. And this is just a better way of testing switches. And again, it's one of these things I just don't understand why. Well, I sort of understand. I mean, creating these tests is actually a lot of work. And so it does make development more challenging. Some people say, hey, well, this is never going to work. This is the foxes guarding the hen house. You've got your software engineers. They're never going to test their own stuff thoroughly. The reality is the exact opposite, that when you've got a QA team to protect you, when there's a customer issue, you say, well, it's not my fault. The QA people are supposed to test this and catch it. Whereas at Arista, there's no one to hide behind, and every developer is acutely aware that if there is a customer problem, it is their fault. And so people are very cautious with their tests and thorough in creating their tests because they know that is their defense, but that's what's standing between them and a customer outage. And so I think that it's been working extremely well for us. Huge fans of automated tests here.
Sorry, I also remember there was one other thing that I remember talking to, I think it was Doug, about a while back, and there was some feature in OSPF where we were talking about being able to kill the OSPF process, but you didn't need to relearn all the routes, and you had some fancy knobs around that.
Let's see, well, I think what that gets you back to in terms of bugs, I mean, there's the architectural benefits that Ken talked about a lot at the beginning of our talk today about exactly what you're describing, that when our agents are capable of doing stateful restart off of the state stored in SysDB, if we have a bug as a customer, you often don't even know, right? You can't tell. But internally, while we're very happy that our architecture saves us from such bugs, internally, it's not like we're proud of them or anything. We work incredibly hard to make sure they're not there in the first place. And one of the things Ken didn't mention, he talked really about what we call our auto test, our product testing infrastructure. That's the testing that we run against a finished switch product where we take all the software together and test it. That is not where the quality in Arista software begins. Really, where it begins is in the coding phase, where at Arista we generate huge amounts of our code. The code is not all handwritten. It's all that state that's stored in SysDB, all the objects, the programming objects that are used to create that are generated from a schema language. And when you generate large portions of your code, you don't introduce silly bugs into them because you've worked out the bugs in the code that's generated. It's used everywhere. You find those bugs very quickly. But by not rewriting them by hand, you just eliminate the whole class of typo bugs, right? That in these vast quantities of code that I would have had to write by hand, I made mistakes. And then I missed them in my testing. And so there's a whole class of bugs there that go away. The next step in Arista's sort of software quality story is unit testing. Unit testing has caught on to, amazingly well in the world of agile software development that's used all around the world now, basically except outside of networking companies, or inside of networking companies, I should say. Well, here at Arista, we've taken some of the best ideas from agile software development and applied them. Our software, every package has a huge pile of unit tests that go with it. Every time a developer makes a change in that package, before the code goes anywhere, we rerun all of those unit tests. It's self-defense for the code. It's self-defense for me, because when I write the code the first time, I write those tests. When I come back 6 months later and I'm in moron mode and I've forgotten all the assumptions in the code and I break one of those assumptions, it's my unit tests that tell me, and they tell me right away. That mistake does not make its way into the fully integrated software base where now it's hiding among millions of lines of code just waiting for someone to find it. Instead, I find it with my tests that are focused on very tiny portions of the code that are exercising those little pieces as extensively as we can afford to in our test environment before we just run out of time. This is how you find your bugs. You find them early, right? And you find them in small packages, in small pieces where you focus on what's actually happening inside the code. Then you take that, you put all those pieces together that are already well tested, you layer on the full level of automated product test, regression test that runs 24 hours a day and never gives up. That's where you get software quality at Arista from.
I want to actually talk about a third aspect of testing, which is the nature of the tests themselves. If you look at the test plans in most QA organizations, they're what I call monkey tests. It's like, first, type in configure interface Ethernet 1, then set the MTU to 1600, then, just sort of scripted steps exactly in some fixed order. The thing about automated tests is that when you automate your tests properly, you can get past that. You can create tests which are themselves programs that contain a model of the system being tested and methodically and exhaustively explore the state space of that model. We generate all the possible spanning tree topologies up to some number of nodes, and then in those topologies, run the spanning tree protocol methodically through every state, right? And hit corner cases that you just never find through just turning spanning tree on a couple of switches and letting it converge. So there's once you're properly automating your tests, you can be much more clever in the way you construct those tests and vastly expand the test coverage compared with manual testing.
Yeah, we've actually embraced this model-based testing or sort of a design philosophy in testing that's really been very, very successful in terms of replaying all the different events in all the possible orders. And it's better, the approach we take is better than random testing, because random testing, you don't find all the corners. So we actually, our model-based test drivers identify all of the orders, even the ones that are unlikely, instead of replaying the likely ones over and over and over again. So it just finds, if I'm in this particular state, what happens if I get a TCAM packet? Or what happens if I get a link down when I'm in this very, very unlikely state where I've timed out and I'm the root bridge and, so very particular state. So we identify all of the states, and then in every single state, we consider every possible event transition that could happen in that state. And we've used this very successfully for multicast routing protocols, for instance. We've used this approach to identify every state. And let me tell you, a lot of corner cases in like sparse mode PIM. And we really identified a lot of corner case tricky bugs that customers would never find.
I regard sparse mode PIM as a corner case in its own right.
Escaped.
Thank you very much.
Yes. They never escaped into the field because we applied this model-based testing, which really has worked out tremendously well, I think.
Okay. Well, what I want to do is I want to shift to, I've got a whole bunch of questions here. I've been answering them while we've been working through. If the listeners have got any more questions they want to fire in, now's your big chance. Because what I want to do is spend about 10 minutes just focusing on those questions. And then if we've got any more topics that we want to jump back onto that, we're coming up on an hour and I know that people's time is valuable. So would it be all right if I just throw you guys some quick fire questions?
Of course.
Okay, so Brandon asks, why does Arista have such a progressive and adaptable OS and chose a legacy CLI interface?
Oh, that's very simple. We want to minimize the transition cost to our customers. Our customers come very well-trained, big staffs of people who understand that particular CLI, and we actually copied it slavishly. It's like even the things that we thought were really silly, we went ahead and copied them anyway, because we wanted it to be as seamless an experience for our customers as possible. And something I'm still hoping an enterprise enterprising customer will do is our CLI is just like the shell, right? And just like Unix supports multiple shells, there's no reason why EOS can't have multiple CLIs. So if anybody wants to do a cool modern CLI for EOS, hey, we're a real big fan.
So you want to have Python, a Cisco CLI and a Juniper CLI?
That would be a dream come true. So any volunteers to do the Juniper CLI, I have lots of milkshakes here. I'm very happy to finance the activity that way.
Can you talk about link aggregation, and can you talk about multi-chassis link aggregation, and can you talk about does Arista have something in place where you can manage multiple switches as one great big switch, kind of that unified fabric idea that's awful trendy in data centers these days? So I threw a lot of things into one because they're all kind of related.
So there are several questions. First of all, multi-chassis link aggregation is a great feature. We've had it for, I think, a year and a half now or something like that. And turning two switches into one is such a wonderful thing from a resilience point of view, from a bandwidth expansion point of view. It's I believe, the fundamentally the best way to scale layer 2 within a data center context. And I think that if you look at the scale of layer 2 networks you can build with multi-chassis link aggregation, you'll realize that there isn't any need for more. I mean, we get to something like 9,000 line rate server connections at layer 2. And it's just, we don't have a customer use case that we've encountered for larger layer 2 domains than that. And so I think you look at stuff like Trill or Fabric Path or whatever, and you say, well, do I really need this complexity when I have such a simple standards-based way of accomplishing this? In terms of multi-device management, I think it's really important to separate out two separate things. First of all is managing multiple devices from one point. Managing the overall data center, I'm nervous about the term fabric, but I'll use it anyway, managing the data center fabric from one place. And the second issue is, do you use a standard control plane or a proprietary control plane? And there's this fallacy being perpetrated on us that in order to get the convenience of single point of management, you need to throw out all the standards and put proprietary tags on all your packets and get locked into one vendor for the rest of your natural life, and have a control plane that nobody outside of some small engineering group at some company somewhere knows how to debug. I just think it's the wrong direction for the industry. And the Arista direction is that single management, centralized management, is a great thing. And we have multiple efforts undergoing. There are different perspectives on it. Do you want to do this controller-based? How automated is it? Is it fundamentally CLI, but one CLI to rule them all? There are different ways of doing it. We have a bunch of stuff we can show you about sort of early versions of that, both in terms of partnering with people doing sort of OpenFlow-based cloud controllers and also through our own CloudVision efforts. And so central management is a great thing. It's going to happen, but that does not mean you need to throw out the industry standard control plane and replace it with some proprietary fabric technology. So Arista has no plans to do anything like that. Our plans around single point of management all embrace and incorporate other devices into the network, rather than pretending that your entire network is going to be a single vendor.
What about OpenFlow? We saw a lot of buzz around OpenFlow as a result of being at Interop last week, and I've been a bit of a fanboy. Is your architecture ready for it if it actually takes off? I mean, Ivan's a bit of an unbeliever, but...
Well, so OpenFlow is a very interesting case, and I think that all the drivers for centralizing network management and getting that sort of under automated control are very powerful drivers. And as I said, I believe that is going to happen, and Arista has several efforts along those lines. What I would say about OpenFlow specifically, well, so first of all, if you've read the OpenFlow 1.0 spec, I think OpenFlow 1.0 isn't quite ready for prime time. Arista has no immediate plans to support OpenFlow 1.0,
That said, we have ported the Open vSwitch onto our switch. And one of the wonderful things about being Linux-based is it's so easy to take a piece of open source software like the Open vSwitch and just run it. So we're actually forwarding traffic in lab based on OpenFlow controllers today. So absolutely, our architecture is amenable to this paradigm. That said, whenever I've had an actual customer conversation about what they're trying to accomplish with OpenFlow, what we've always come to is, well, OpenFlow doesn't actually quite do that today, right? So once OpenFlow actually does something, once OpenFlow actually does something that somebody actually wants, then we'd be very happy to have our switches do that as well. There's this whole argument made that OpenFlow commoditizes switches. I don't believe it for a minute. I think OpenFlow increases the value of switches by giving you yet another way of using switches to build a more valuable network. So there's no opposition. I mean, Arista is a big fan of the paradigm, and once OpenFlow is doing useful things for our customers, we have every intent to support it.
I just want to make sure it does. I'm a big fan because I think if I encourage it, people might actually see some value and we'll see more of it. So moving on to another question, there's been several people, but Bill's one of the people who've asked, can we run virtual emulators of your switches on desktop hardware, you know, and build test environments where we can validate stuff?
Well, we do it all the time in our own development environment, but we have not yet packaged this in a customer-accessible way. It's on our list of plans, but today that's unfortunately not available.
John is asking, please describe the high availability redundancy model for preserving sysdb state.
I'm sorry, I wanted to just follow on to the previous question was that we do have a VEOS, which is an OVF image that contains EOS. So it's fine for playing around with the management plane, but it doesn't have any data path. So it's not quite
That's a completely different thing. VEOS is just a CLI front end for VMware's vSwitch.
Exactly right. It gives the network administrator visibility into the virtualized network that's currently off limits unless you provision a vCenter license to every network administrator and train them on vCenter GUI.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a CLI front end to the vSwitch, but it doesn't allow me to test your features like, I don't know, OSPF or spanning tree or anything else.
That's right. Also an SNMP interface, so you get SNMP access to all your vCenter.
Yeah, code. I can read the counters of the VM NICs, yes.
Exactly.
But as Ken mentioned, what you're asking for is something that we use internally every day. This is a big part of how we test our features, how we develop our features. We don't test them all on actual switch hardware. Mostly we test them on our laptops, and we do that with tools exactly what you're looking for. We just haven't gotten to the point where we packaged them up and made them available to our customers yet.
Which is something we should totally do. It's on my wish list for sure. Yeah.
Just a quick question on the sales side from Bill. He says, does the software have any feature limits or licensing? Or is it just, you know, one, when you buy the product, does the whole thing run? That might be a marketing question a bit, Phil, but I think it's relevant to ask.
You know, I'm the marketing guy, and I promise not to say anything, but it's hard for marketing guys to do that. Since there's a sales and marketing question, I guess I get a little bit of a license to say something. There's only one software binary that ships for each release. It supports all the hardware and supports all the features. There are some components on that are licensed, but at this time the license, you know, there's no hard license enforcement. If you want to turn a feature on, kick the tires, see if it works for you, you can do that. What we do ask is, you know, certainly from a trust model, you know, if you're going to turn on layer 3, BGP, VM Tracer, and, you know, those types of things that are, you know, do have separate licenses, if you put them into production and you're using them, you know, please pay the license. But if you're going to kick the tires on it, I mean, make sure it's going to work for you before you sign up for a purchase order.
What we will never do is we will never create software that shuts off features based on licensing problems, right? We might have it whine at you a lot, but we are never going to take your network down because there's some licensing issue. That's just not going to happen with Arista.
Just flipping through a few more questions here. Norman says he wants to volunteer to write a Junos CLI for your switch.
Woohoo!
All right.
Shall I get him? So, Norman, if you send me your details, I'd be more than pleased to pass them on to the guys because I'm pretty sure they'd be cheese. And Norman also asks, can you describe the implications of losing the heartbeat connection between two switches in an MLAG cluster? I'm not sure that's an Arista-specific question, is it really? Maybe
it is, because every MLAG implementation is specific.
Yep, I agree.
Okay.
I mean, if we lose the heartbeat, the MLAG connection will break apart. One of them will become the I mean, the primary switch will take over, so the lags will fall back to one of the switches. The spanning tree will split apart, and so one of them will become the root bridge. So there'll be a spanning tree event if you lose the heartbeat connection. If you just temporarily lose the heartbeat, then this will happen temporarily, and it will reconstruct. I mean, we've protected the heartbeats and the inner switch link. You know, the recommendation is that you use a multi-port channel for redundancy, of course, and the heartbeats are protected with QoS, so the heartbeats aren't going to be lost based on anything other than a true loss in your network. There's, you know, no chance that congestion on the peer link will cause loss of the heartbeat messages.
The boxes remain independent, and if you lose the heartbeats, just the port channels fall apart.
Yeah, I mean, the boxes, we don't shut down the links. We don't, you know, the box doesn't shut off. It's like it just falls back into two switches. So a little bit is dependent on what happens on the server side or how you've got the server side configured that's connecting to it. If you're running layer 3, for instance, we have this virtual ARP feature. We call it VARP, but it's basically sort of like VRRP without the protocol. And that will keep
active
VRRP of sorts. So if your host is using the MLAG link as its uplink and the routers that are acting as the MLAG as their first hop gateway, then they'll just continue to route packets even if it's broken apart because they're both acting as active, and whether the MLAG is formed or not, they'll continue to route traffic. But it's a little, you know, it's specific to how the network is configured.
Okay, well, I guess we've got time for just a couple more questions. Is there any more topics that you wanted to cover from the presentation? Guys, I know that we've probably jumped around a little bit and maybe broken your flow. Is there any other areas you wanted to tell us about in the EOS?
I think we're all good over here.
You're all good. You've had so much excitement you can hardly stand it. Like, a couple of people quickly asked, your architecture is some parallels with Junos. Would you see EOS being very different from Junos?
I would say that I'm not a Junos expert, I have to admit. I would say that compared to Junos, we do less in the kernel. We don't require every forwarding plane feature to hit the kernel. Got all the drivers out of the kernel. I think those are maybe the bigger differences. I'm not sure if there's people with more Junos expertise than I have the comment. We tend to know the Cisco environments better because most of us are Cisco transplants.
And what about symmetric multiprocessing? Jeremy's asking a little bit about individual processes being multiprocessing aware. Does that allow you to scale better?
Well, we actually prefer to avoid multi-threading because multi-threading makes programming much, much more complicated. So our agents are almost all of them single-threaded. Two exceptions, I think. However, we scale very nicely on a multiprocessor because we are multiprocess. Each process can use its own core, and in fact, the Arista switch is a dual-core CPU on there, so it can easily run two processes at once, and the SysDB decoupling makes that work without any locks or any concurrency control issues.
I mean, and another example of that is in the modular system in the 7508 or the 7504 chassis, the hardware agent is actually split into 8 different agents, one that manages each line card. So we take advantage of multiprocessing there because the line cards, it's a dual-core CPU, as Ken said, and so they're working simultaneously on different cores.
And the cool thing is when you remove a line card, we just kill the process. And like we've avoided this whole class of hop swap bugs that have dogged our competitors because it's so simple to just kill a process when you remove the line card.
Yeah, it's actually really nice. It removes the line card. The state, all the state gets kind of cut out as from SysDB, sort of as though you went into Unix and did rmdir on the line card. So it just goes in and it removes all of the state from SysDB that's pertinent to that line card, and whatever state the agent happened to be in, there's no like funny case of I was trying to write this hardware and I got a SIG bus because the PCIe link went away to that interface. It's just like it doesn't happen, so it gets a SIG bus, in fact, when a line card is removed because we're trying to write a piece of hardware that's gone. The agent dies, and then another agent notices that it went away, and it cleans up all the SysDB state associated with that line card, and it disappears. It's actually very, very nice.
So does that mean you'll have multiple processes per port, or will you fork it?
We have a process per card, but not per port. So we have a process, we tend to have a process per FRU of sorts, but not all the way down to like the individual SFP or the individual removable connector.
Have we got any other issues? Anything else we want to cover for today, or I think we're getting close to a wrap-up?
Pretty good on this end. We're feeling real good on this end, Greg.
Right.
Okay. Well, I think we might call it a show. And thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers webinar, the very first edition. I hope it wasn't too rough around the edges. I'd like to very much thank the guys from Arista for joining us around the virtual workbench. Adam, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks a lot.
And Ken, thank you very much for coming on. It's been great to speak to you. I think I spoke to you a while back, and I was really impressed with the way this system works.
Oh, thanks. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, and Hugh, is it your fault that you put PIM sparse mode in there? Did I get that right?
Oh, I don't know if you can blame me. Maybe blame Doug. But but if there's bugs in the code, it's my fault. But I guarantee there are no bugs.
Then I'm not going to thank you. I'd be happier if multicast went away, but that might just be me, you know. So thanks for joining in on the show, and of course thank Ethan. Ethan, what are you going to be doing for the week? Have you got more toys to play with us?
Oh, right back to firewall migrations. I've been migrating a lot of stuff to some new Cisco firewall hardware, and I'm going to get right back to that, one audit at a time.
And it's good to have you back, mate. I'm glad you've found some time to join us once again. It's good to have you on the show. And, of course, our very good friend Ivan Pepelniak from iOS Hints. Now, Ivan, what's happening with you, mate?
Just finished the VMware networking webinar, so just polishing the edges now. And then I'm looking forward to delivering it.
Oh, that's good. I'll make sure I come along and heckle on that.
I do.
As always, you can contact the Packet Pushers on their website at packetpushers.net. You can email me, packetpushers@gmail.com, and tell me how this show went and whether you'd like more. I'd really appreciate any feedback that you have. Don't forget that you can follow us on the Twitter as @packetpushers. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.
Thank you.